It's Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Welcome to the fourth episode of The Lines Between Us, WIPR's year-long examination of inequality in the Baltimore region. So far, we've focused on the roots of residential segregation and inequality during the 20th century. Today, we'll talk about the contemporary housing crisis, foreclosures. 4 years ago, the New York Times did a series on foreclosures in Baltimore's Bel Air Edison, a working-class neighborhood in northeast Baltimore that's proud of its high home ownership rate, but is struggling with a high rate of foreclosures. In its series, the Times interviewed Anjanette Booker, who runs the Vixen Hair Salon on Bel Air Road. 4 years earlier, she had taken out a mortgage on a brick row house with an $841 monthly payment. When the Times talked to her, that payment had doubled to more than $1,700. This week I went to the salon to see how Ms. Booker is doing today. Let me go back to when you got the mortgage. As I understand it, you wanted to get a fixed rate loan.
Yes. I wanted a fixed rate, and I thought I was getting a fixed rate, not understanding that I had an adjustable rate. This was my first time actually buying a house, so it's so many different ways that I could have gotten a better deal that I didn't know about.
So what have you done?
Well, I haven't paid the mortgage in 2 years, and I have another house that my grandparents left me, and it needed some work done on it. So for the last 2 years, I've been fixing that house up just in case I have to move in it.
But the lender basically said, if you can't pay this full new higher amount, then don't pay at all.
Right. They said, if you can't send the full amount, don't pay anything. You can't send anything because we'll send it right back to you. So I haven't paid anything in 2 years.
And you're trying to get a modification of the loan. Tell me about that.
I've been trying to get a loan modification, and every time I send the paperwork in, it's always something that's not there or is too late because I didn't get it in. They said, even though I sent everything, and they have confirmed that I sent everything, it's just that I have to keep doing it over, like every 2 to 3 months is the modification for the last 2 years. So I'm doing it again. I'm sending the paperwork in again.
Do you think that this neighborhood is especially hard hit?
I think it is. It's low income. With my experience with getting my first mortgage by myself, single because of divorce, it was like we kind of didn't know. I didn't know the whole full, everything that I need to know about mortgage. I mean, before it was me and my husband, I just sat there and signed the paper. He took care of everything, but it was me by myself, and I thought I knew, and I didn't know. So when you don't know, especially in neighborhoods where there is a lower income, and we're so excited about having our own, you know, always, because that's how we've been raised, to have our own and always have your own. Sometimes we pretty much overlook a certain things when people present it to us a certain way, you know. So if it's, now I look at it, if it's too good to be true, it is too good to be true.
How are things in the neighborhood these days? Are they as bad as they were 4 or 5 years ago?
I see in my neighborhood where my home is, I see signs still up. They're selling, but they're selling at short sales, or people are just moving out.
And who's buying the houses?
I guess, investors are buying them and then they're renting them out.
I have to tell you, I have not heard many cases like this where a banker says, you can just stay there even though you're not paying.
Right. It's like they want, every time they call, they ask, are you still living in the house? I'm like, yes. And they're like, oh, okay. You know, they want to make sure someone is in the house that is not empty. And once I send everything in, they'll be like, okay, we'll check it and send it to the underwriters, and then they'll call back and say it's something. And then I try to get it in. About time I try to get it in before whatever the date they say, it's too late. You know, it's always too late or something else is wrong.
You look really frustrated.
I am. I am really frustrated, but I'm trying to let it just be and let it happen. Whatever happens, happen. You know, at this point, that's where I'm at, because I'm having some health issues, just worrying about it. So I'm just going to try to let it be and keep doing what I have to do, and we're going to see what happens.
Anjanette Booker owns the Vixen Hair Salon in Baltimore's Bel Air Edison neighborhood. This is 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast.
I'm assistant producer Jamila Kay. You're listening to Maryland Mornings, the Lines Between Us series on WYPR 88.1 in Baltimore. Visit our website, linesbetweenus.org, to hear more stories, to see maps that reveal the lines in your neighborhood, and to participate in the discussion. Thanks for downloading this week's show. Now back to the podcast.
Maryland Morning Senior Producer Lawrence Lanahan joins me now to walk through some of the ways race and class played into the foreclosure crisis. He's been knee-deep in this stuff for the last couple of weeks. Hi, Lawrence.
Hey, Sheila.
This series is looking at how various problems exacerbated race and class divisions. We've looked at redlining, blockbusting, the spread of vacants. How did foreclosures play out along race and class lines?
Well, it played out right in the front yard. This crisis kind of turned banks into landlords when they had all these foreclosed houses on their hands. You know, they're responsible for maintaining these things. And I came across a report by the National Fair Housing Alliance, and it says that if you look at the homes that banks own because of foreclosures, if those homes are in neighborhoods that are majority people of color, African Americans, Latinos, they're not maintained as well if you compare them to houses in white neighborhoods or more diverse neighborhoods. And they actually looked in Maryland. They looked at Prince George's County and Montgomery County, and they just found that, you know, the houses are maintained a little worse in the places where subprime lending was the worst. And the problem, what happens when it's concentrated in these neighborhoods, is the spillover effect. This report talks about property values declining around these concentrations of poorly maintained houses. And what that means is that you've got wealth disappearing in a big way from communities of color when the neglect is concentrated in those places. And then there's the loss of revenue to cities and counties. Nobody's in those homes.
Right. And that spillover effect was a big part of Baltimore City's lawsuit against Wells Fargo, right?
Right. Yeah. Subprime lending was behind some of the foreclosures. And that kind of lending took place disproportionately among people of color. Some of the data show that African Americans were more likely to be offered subprime loans, even when they could have qualified for prime. And, you know, if they're pushing those kinds of loans, that leads to accusations of targeting those subprime loans to certain racial or ethnic groups. So that's what the Wells Fargo suit was all about. George Nielsen is the solicitor for the city, and we have some tape here of him in January 2010 on our show. He's been on our show
throughout the last three years
as the suit moves
to
the courts. And he's sort of explaining his logic in suing Wells Fargo over these foreclosures. The first part of that logic for him is that subprime loans lead to foreclosures, lead to vacants.
Once the home goes vacant, certain things happen to the city. The vacant home becomes a haven for miscreants, generates lots of police calls, people inappropriately and illegally living in the home, fire department calls, etc. So there are very specific expenses that are incurred by the city specific to that property.
So how did that argument play with the judge?
The judge bounced it right back to the city. He sent it back and said, you know, the city can't really prove the full range of damages it was claiming for the whole city. You can't say Wells Fargo, out of all these different banks, just Wells Fargo had this many foreclosures and it just hit the whole city. So it went back and forth a couple times with the judge and the city. So the city would keep narrowing down and whittling down the damage claims more tightly around specific properties. Like, okay, this house was foreclosed on and these houses around it suffered from it. And finally, in April of 2011, the judge said the suit could move forward.
And meanwhile, the suit included depositions and statements from with some really stunning allegations by former Wells Fargo employees.
Yeah, I mean, these were employees who were making these loans, but then they came forward and said, oh, you know, communities of color were targeted for subprime loans. They said that loan officers used slurs that don't deserve repeating here. The thing is this July, Wells Fargo settled with the city after all this bouncing back and forth. They're not admitting to any of the allegations. I mean, it's a settlement. They say it's about avoiding litigation. So to me, the settlement kind of leaves it as a he said, she said. You know, of course, it also brought over $7 million to the city, but the allegations, unsettled, as it were.
The allegations about targeting, whether
right.
subprime loans were targeted to
right.
minority borrowers. What does research say about targeting?
Well, it's pretty clear in the research that the subprime loans did happen disproportionately among communities of color. But as far as They happen there. The intent was their targeting, and it kind of depends on which research you look at. I read a working paper from the Levy Economics Institute of Bard College this week. They set this whole question up by asking, quote, why were borrowers who previously had been excluded from equal access to mortgage credit instead super included in a subprime lending?
Well, that's a good question.
Yeah, and so they looked at a bunch of studies. It was they call it a MESO analysis. I'm not going to drag everybody during a pledge drive into what a MESA.
Please, unless
don't
do that.
Unless you really want me to. But they looked at all these studies and said there's basically two sides out there in research land talking right past each other. The economists, they say, just ignore race. They just portray this as a function of the market. On the one hand, irresponsible borrowers. On the other hand, unscrupulous lenders. Other social scientists, they say, ignore the market, but they do, you know, take account of the legacy of racial inequality in lending over the century, of the 20th century.
And do I understand that that argument is essentially that for decades there were insufficient opportunities for borrowers of color?
Yeah, for banking and credit. The big banks didn't have branches there. The payday loans kind of filled the void. Subprimes competing with payday loans. It's just a whole different dynamic of borrowing there, which makes people more vulnerable. So the Bard paper says the social scientists, they say, yeah, it's happening here. They rely on correlations, you know, that the subprime lending is happening in the communities of color. But as far as intent, you know, they kind of come up short. There's not really causality. The Wells Fargo suit is a good test of intent. You know, you've got these specific allegations of these loan officers targeting these communities. But the settlement just makes it less clear-cut than I think a lot of people would like. I mean, you can look at the city's complaint online and decide for yourself. So
we've been talking a lot about subprime lending. How much of Baltimore's foreclosure crisis had to do with subprime lending?
Well, there's plenty of subprime lending here, but it's definitely not the only culprit. The nonprofit investigative news organization ProPublica, they wrote a piece in 2010 called Foreclosures Don't Always Follow Script. And they looked at three areas, Maricopa County in Arizona, Seattle, and Baltimore, all three places hit by foreclosures. And they start the story by setting up the conventional narrative, the same as the economist we just mentioned. They said, quote, rapacious lenders hooked up with irresponsible buyers in a tale of lending gone wild. But then ProPublica looked at the data. They actually got a random sample of foreclosure filings from these three areas, including Baltimore. I mean, they went to the courts. And it turns out there were foreclosures for lots of other reasons. Jennifer LaFleur of ProPublica helped report the story. And here's what she found in Baltimore.
You know, a lot of people had loans that were for purchasing a house, whereas other places had a lot more refinances. Baltimore tended to have more fixed-rate loans, but they did have higher interest rates overall. You know, a lot of people were first-time home buyers that may not have been educated as to what their options were. You know, and I think a lot of people might have gone into purchases where they thought they could handle it, and then just one little thing happened. Somebody got sick, you know, somebody lost their job. For me personally, it was just, you know, kind of an opportunity lost. So a lot of people who thought they, you know, could finally have their dream and finally have a house, it just went wrong for a lot of people.
You also found some research about the effect of foreclosures in particular on school children.
Yeah, sadly, this has been going on long enough and deep enough that they can start focusing on these little areas. And yeah, people are starting to focus on what it does to children. The Brookings Institution has a report at the national level. And right here, the Baltimore Neighborhood Indicators Alliance, they're the folks who make our maps for the series at the University of Baltimore. They looked at Baltimore public school children specifically. Matthew Kachora wrote the report, and I talked to him this week. He said 3% of public school children here in any given year are affected by foreclosure. Last time they checked, in the 08-09 school year, that meant 2,400 children had been affected by foreclosure. Almost every school had at least one of these children. The average was 12 per school. And the problem is that families in foreclosure often move, sometimes out of a school district, and if they're losing their house, they're not necessarily moving to a better place. You know, sometimes you move a kid to a better neighborhood, they'll do better. They're not moving to better neighborhoods. Then the children lose their friends, their adult role models in the community. They have to switch textbooks and lesson plans if it's in the middle of the year, and it can lead to a whole slew of problems, academic problems, social problems, behavioral problems. And Kachora says people are finally sort of coming out with some solutions to this problem.
Well, I know the Urban Institute has held roundtables here in Baltimore City to try to bring together housing counseling agencies, foreclosure prevention groups, as well as the schools, to try to find areas where they can work together to address foreclosure. So really what you look to try to do is maintain a place for a child. So it would be housing programs to try to keep the family in the home.
They've also got this clever strategy where they're looking at federal laws that help homeless children, and then they're saying, kid gets foreclosed on, they're out of a house. They're technically homeless, and now these federal laws and programs can help them as, you know, homeless children.
Thanks for walking us through it, Lawrence.
Sure.
Thanks. It's Marilyn Morning on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Lawrence Lanahan also visited Bel Air Edison this week to see how the community is trying to weather the foreclosure crisis. He went to the office of a community association, Bel Air Edison Neighborhoods Incorporated, and talked to Executive Director Johnette Richardson and Marketing Director Mary Bushel.
Bel Air Edison is the kind of neighborhood a city needs. Good housing stock, and home prices affordable enough for low and middle-income families.
We're a working class, pretty big middle-class neighborhood, I would say, yes. We get a lot of teachers, EMT, police officers, firefighters.
That's Johnette Richardson, Executive Director of Bel Air Edison Neighborhoods, Inc., or Benny. Bel Air Edison has kept an enviable home ownership rate, 67%. It was closer to 80% a decade ago. But between 2002 and 2007 alone, the rate dropped 9%. During those same 5 years, the median sale price doubled. So as homeowners moved out, investors moved in. Then the bust came.
Because of foreclosures, now our values have decreased significantly. It's now a prime environment that's inviting to investors. And so we're talking about small investors who are like, let me take a little equity out of my home and buy an investment property and get a tenant. And so not always the kind of investor that really knows how to do this responsibly.
Richardson's Neighborhood Association is working hard to keep the remaining homeowners around. The tricky thing about having lots of working class homeowners is that they are the ones most vulnerable to foreclosures in a bad economy. Mary Bushel is Benny's marketing director. She tries to reach out to neighbors before they get caught up in the foreclosure process. One way is to figure out who's behind on city taxes.
Anything you owe Baltimore City and have not paid, they can technically sell at the end of the year, and it becomes a lien against title to your property. So whoever buys it, because it's a lien against title, like they could foreclose on your home.
Johnette Richardson says Benny digs through public records to see who's on the tax sale list. Many of them don't know they're on it.
And we would carve out all the people in our community that fell on that list and do a direct mail to them. It not only informed the homeowner that they made the list, but it also encouraged them to come in for counseling. And what we would find is that a lot of them were in trouble with their mortgage.
Benny also participates in Healthy Neighborhoods, a stimulus-funded program through which St. Ambrose Housing Aid buys foreclosed homes, renovates them, and then partners with Benny to market the houses. Richardson says it's the neighbors that make the program work.
We have access through Healthy Neighborhoods to a small grant pool so that the block can do a block beautification project where neighbors are working together. They're deciding, you know, what is the project? Are we planting flowers? Are we installing lighting?
Stimulus-funded programs don't last forever, and the housing market has yet to fully recover. Richardson looks to Bel Air Edison's resilient past to find hope for the future.
We've actually endured white flight, flipping, predatory lending. We have the kind of neighbors that if a foreclosure happens on their block, they're out there ready to mow lawns if it gets high on a vacant property, ready to shovel snow. Having them invested in our work, having them invested in this community has made all the difference for us. And I think it's what separates the foreclosure story in our neighborhood versus a different neighborhood who may not have that level of investment.
Thanks for that report, Lawrence.
No problem.
That's Lines Between Us for today. Drop by linesbetweenus.org for a list of events in the region addressing the issues of race, class, and community. There's one about diversity in the arts at the UB Blake Cultural Center on the 28th.
And the Johns Hopkins Center for Talented Youth wants middle schoolers to enter an essay contest about the role of race in public policy. That that's going to be, I couldn't have done that in sixth grade, but they said they've, you know, gotten great essays from these kids. Information about that's also at linesbetweenus.org.
And we hope you'll join us for a free documentary screening on Monday, October 29th. We're partnering with the Enoch Pratt Free Library to show Race, the Power of an Illusion.
Yeah, I've seen this. It's a really powerful and really enlightening documentary. Kind of walks you through the 20th century at the national level, looking at policies that exacerbated inequality.
I'll host a panel discussion afterward, and we'll solicit a few audience questions at the end. That's October 29th, a week from Monday, at the Pratt Central Library. Information at, of course, linesbetweenus.org.
Mary Rose Madden has been tenacious in covering foreclosures for WYPR's newsroom. When she heard The Lines Between Us was focusing on foreclosures, she went out and found her own angle, renters who got tied up in foreclosure. Here's her piece, which ran the same morning as our episode.
Deidre Peace paid about $700 a month for a one-bedroom apartment in Northwood. Then one day in late August, a random visitor knocked on her door
and said this house was going up for foreclosure, the house was going up for auction, and they wanted to take a look around. And I'm like, are you kidding me? I said, my landlord never told me that.
Peace says she received no written notice, nor a phone call from her landlord.
Next thing I know, the auctioneers were going to front auctioning the house off, and I was still living in the house.
She said her mind started racing with panic.
And all I could think about is, I have to go, I have to move.
Peace called Baltimore Neighborhood Inc.'s Tenant Landlord Foreclosure Hotline. Nokomis Johns, who runs the hotline, says Peace is a lot like many of the calls they get.
Mostly people are concerned about thinking they're about to get put out. They think they can be evicted immediately, and that's not true. If they're considered a bona fide tenant by the law, then they have the right to fulfill their lease or have at least an additional 90 days to remain in the property.
Johns is talking about a federal law that passed in 2009 called Protecting Tenants at Foreclosure. Matt Hill from the Public Justice Center says that law is supposed to protect tenants and their lease.
Whoever buys at the foreclosure sale steps into the shoes of the old landlord. So they get to collect rent, but they also have the obligations of being the landlord.
Hill points out that most foreclosures are bought by the banks or whatever financial institution had the mortgage, and that creates all kinds of problems.
Well, the reality is that most of the time when a bank or some sort of financial trust takes over these properties, they really don't want to continue renting the property. They want to evict the tenants. And there are exceptions to that. Certain financial institutions have hired property managers.
Hill says sometimes the bank will offer the tenant cash for keys, and that can be a good deal for the tenant, but it doesn't always happen.
If the tenant, if they're not offered a cash for keys deal, if the tenant wants to continue renting the property, and there are certain conditions on the property like leaky roofs, no heat, significant mold, broken doors, these are common. And if the tenant wants to continue renting the property, but the purchaser, again, usually the bank, doesn't want to rent the property, they generally just ignore the tenant, and then those conditions become worse.
In this situation, Hill says, the bank or the financial institution has become a deadbeat landlord. The tenant may decide to move, but Hill and many others say the options for affordable, habitable rental housing are sparse.
There's not a whole lot of places for them to go, but some of these other properties that are in often equally bad conditions. But where they're still expected to pay substantial rents. And so what you see is just overall is a dilapidated housing stock where many landlords just get by doing the very bare minimum they can.
Take Deidre Peace. She was paying for an apartment that had no heat for 3 months last winter.
And I'm 60 years old, you know, and I get sick with the respiratory and all of that. And I didn't complain to him. I said, you need to get some heat. Yeah, Ms. Peace, I'm working on that.
The low to moderate income rental market in Baltimore is decreasing. More than 5,000 rental properties were foreclosed on from 2009 to 2011. It's made slim pickings even slimmer for folks like Peace. I'm Mary Rose Madden reporting for 88.1 WYPR.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Lines Between Us, WYPR's year-long exploration of inequality in the Baltimore region. This is Maryland Morning senior producer Lawrence Lanahan. Now, join the conversation at facebook.com/thelinesbetweenus or tell us your story at linesbetweenus.org. The Lines Between Us is made possible by grants from Associated Black Charities, Cohen Opportunity Fund, Ethics and Excellence in Journalism Foundation, Baltimore Community Foundation, and Open Society Institute Baltimore, as well as support from members of the WYPR Board of Directors. I hope you'll join us again on Friday at 9 a.m. on 88.1 FM in the Baltimore region, and everywhere else, streaming live at WYPR.org. Have a great day.